Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, hello again, my folks, my wonderful, wonderful audience. You're so loyal and terrific, smart, up to date. You know so much just from our guests. You know, I think if you follow our guests, you're going to know more about what's going on in COVID-19 and also in psychiatry than the vast majority of experts in the fields. Because the people I have coming here to talk are the actual truth speakers. And my guest today, Patrick Hahn, many of you know him from being guests on my show, watching my show over the years. Patrick is one of the best researchers I know of. He's a professor at Loyola. He's a journalist. He has a previous book that deals with the so-called genetics of mental illness, which don't really exist. It's just a figment of the biological psychiatrist's wishes and imaginations and Christmas list and so on. Doesn't exist. Patrick has done a really, really good book called Prescription for Sorrow. I often don't get a chance to look at books for the show, but I've been looking at Patrick's for a few weeks now, and I get a chance, and it's really good. I mean, it's really good. And I'm going to hold it up here. I didn't do a test on this, but here it is. Does that look good, Patrick?
Yes.
Prescription for Sorrow. The focus is on the antidepressants and suicide and violence. But by reading this book, you'll really get a profound sense of the shenanigans, what goes on, how dangerous they are in terms of causing violence, suicide, psychosis, and sexual suppression, and a variety of other dreadful things. But also, it'll educate you on how to look at controlled clinical trials, how to look at claims. He does a really good job, and I'm smiling because it's one of the few works that I read, Patrick's book and his earlier book, where I smile because, well, there's something I didn't know, or there's something I didn't quite think of for myself, and it's really enlightening. So I really recommend Prescription for Sorrow, so much so that you can see I'm giving it a bit of a push here, which will surprise most of you because I often don't do that. Now, I also want to talk about something very exciting to me and to Ginger, and I think important to the world, which is we have put on advance sale our book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators. COVID-19 and the Global Predators. And the subtitle is We Are the Prey. And this book has introductions by the top people in the field, the cutting edge people of COVID-19, which is a great joy to me because we're all new to this field and none of these doctors knew me 10 months ago, and they've been reviewing the manuscript with me, and they just thought enough of it to want to do introductions. One of them is Peter McCullough, who has done the single most important review with 56 or 7 joint authors, and him as senior author on the treatment, early treatment of COVID-19. Another is Zev Zelenko, an amazing doctor who's gotten him, well, everybody's getting in trouble for what they're doing, but he's really taken tremendous blows for what he's been doing. And also Elizabeth Lee Valit, another physician. And you've seen them all on my YouTube channel. They're all there. And they've all written introductions. It's a totally comprehensive book. And it will really, for the first time, get you beyond conspiracy theories to see that behind the masks, behind the dreadful vaccines, behind the shutdowns, there is indeed a very large collaborative group of people. I'll name the names. I'll name the corporations. I'll name the agencies who want to weaken America and strengthen communist China. It's quite bizarre. I never imagined having a finding like that in my entire life. But we outline it. Now, you can get the book on a dedicated website we've set up, which is www.wearethepray.com. And also at the top of the Bregan.com, my basic website. But we're doing something I've never heard an author do before. We want this information out. So if you do purchase the book at a real cut rate, actually, you will immediately, when you purchase it, immediately get the manuscript for the book, the whole darn working manuscript, so that you'll be able to begin studying and learning what's going on out there in the world with no additional price at all. It's just a part of our gift to get it out into the world. And we're also sending it out to some of the people around the world that really need to get to see it. So we're trying to spread the word now and get as much information out to you as we can. And the easiest way, again, is the dedicated website, which is simply wearethepray.com. Now, this is a great book, Patrick's Prescription for Sorrow. Actually, I think if you you read these two books, you're going to have a tremendous insight into COVID-19 from my book and psychiatry from his book. And since he's been generous enough to mention some of my books, you could even follow up with some of my earlier work in the field. But I really like this as an introduction book. My own book, Medication Madness, covers a lot of stuff too. Those two books, I think, would just catch you up to a lot of date in this field. So, Patrick, what in the world makes a decent human being like you, who's got a good job teaching and a journalist, dig himself so deep with such intelligence and effort into psychiatric drugs?
Well, this is a journey I began several years ago. I started with my blog on Open Salon, which is a sister website to the online magazine Salon. And I wanted to write about over-medicalization, not specifically psychiatry. But of course, if you want to write about over-medicalization, psychiatry gives you an endless of material to tap. Yeah, my training is not in medicine, it's in zoology. And two things are, I regard as self-evident. One is that our bodies, and remember our brains are part of our bodies evolved to work and to function very well. They didn't evolve to malfunction. And the second is they evolved to function for a time. And then we have to die and get out of the way of the next generation. And I was just appalled at this. Our healthcare expenses are going up year after year after year. And I don't see we're getting very much in return. And the more I looked into this, the more I found that we don't have a system to make people healthy. We have a system to sell as many drugs as possible to as many people as possible. So only 14% of prescription drug costs are paid for out of pocket. So that means 86% are paid by all of us through higher taxes, through higher insurance premiums, or else we pay with our surplus labor at work. And if you don't have employer-based health insurance, your surplus labor is subsidizing those who do. And so the drug companies take our money to manufacture and control the evidence purporting to show their wares are safe and effective. And they take more of our money to pay for so-called continuing education courses for physicians. And they take more of our money to pay the key opinion leaders to tout the drug makers' wares at the meetings. And they take more of our money to produce slick commercial messages telling us that we can't function without their drugs, and we need drugs to help us cope with life's vicissitudes. And so when I returned from Africa in 2012, at the age of 51, I enrolled in the writing program at Johns Hopkins University. And that was the best thing I've ever done. And this journey just keeps getting more and more amazing. And my first article on antidepressants came out in January 2015. Talked to a young woman from the south of England. And her life was just devastated by antidepressant withdrawal. Citalopram, which of course is sold under the trade name Celexa. And she wasn't even depressed. She was prescribed citalopram because of a bad reaction to an antibiotic. She was prescribed for an infection. And she had a bad reaction to the citalopram. And they gave her more diagnoses, more drugs. And eventually, she ended up just destroying her life. She said to me, "I don't have any more feelings except for bad ones." Here's the punchline to all this. Now her doctors are, remember, she was prescribed citalopram for a bad reaction to an antibiotic. She was prescribed for an infection. Now her doctors are telling her she probably never had an infection in the first place. And I began getting interested in antidepressants and suicide. And my first book was on, as you mentioned, it was on the so-called genetic basis of mental illness. And I found out that there is none. Whatever you want to call these conditions, they're not brain diseases. And I began writing this book in, I guess it was 2019, but I'd been writing it in bits and pieces for several years before that. And I was talking with Dr. Kirsch. Of course, you know him. He was the one who revealed that antidepressants are no better in short-term clinical trials than placebos. And I agree with his assessment. He says people who are already taking these drugs and say they're doing well on them, you know, can continue taking them. Doctors should do no new prescribing. The benefits, such as they are, can be replicated in full by any of a variety of non-drug means. The harms are truly devastating. They've known about this since almost as soon as these drugs came out, since the 60s. They knew these drugs caused suicide. And the SSRIs came out. They began developing them in the 80s. And they knew pretty much from the beginning, they knew that these drugs caused healthy volunteers, threw them into a state of intense, violent, suicidal preoccupation. And so these were healthy volunteers. You can't blame the drugs. And Prozac.
You mean you can't blame their mental illness?
Yeah, you can't blame the mental illness. Right, right. That's what I meant to say. Yeah. And of course, Prozac came on the scene 1989. And I remember I was in graduate, there was just this blizzard of news stories, all laudatory. And this was years before I got interested in these issues. And I remember saying to a friend of mine, what is going to happen to all these people making these random alterations to their brain chemistry 5, 10, 20 years down the road? And now we've got our results. The results are in. So consumption of these drugs has gone up. Suicide rate has skyrocketed. The proportion of people disabled by mental illness has skyrocketed. I challenge anyone to name any relevant public health outcome that has gotten better as the consumption of these drugs has increased.
Right. Did you way back then come across my stuff? Because back then, of course, I immediately started to get involved with the Prozac. I was the single medical expert chosen for the first 150 lawsuits against all of them, against Eli Lilly in the beginning. And so I dug into it. And then Ginger and I wrote Talking Back to Prozac. Even in that book, going way back now, I was showing that the drugs are no better than placebo, but they're murderously worse. And it was very, very clear that they had to lie, cheat, and steal. I mean, literally commit fraud in the way they manipulated their studies. They had to put patients on sedatives, addictive sedatives, to calm down what Patrick is describing as this agitation that can lead to no good whatsoever and is terribly painful. And they knew that. They actually passed around a secret memo saying, we're going to go around the FDA rules and we're going to permit you to give sedatives to these people. Because one thing, not only were they having dangerous reactions, they were dropping out. So the only way to even keep a number in the studies was to medicate them with the sedatives. So it was all just rigged from the beginning and with a lot of political connectivity. It's been interesting for me, Patrick. I was going to ask you this before we started talking. Have you gotten into COVID-19 at all? Because to me, the work you and I do, looking at these drug companies and looking at the studies, it carries you right into Anthony Fauci, who sort of all rolled into one as everything bad about the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, I've just started dipping my toes into the COVID sewer. I'm writing some short articles for natural news blogs. I mean, I was dithering. I wanted to do something, but I didn't know what to do. And then I reminded myself, well, I didn't sit down and write a book about antidepressants the first day I got interested in the subject.
Right.
I let it develop gradually. So that's what I'm doing with the COVID. And I've looked into the masks. They do no good. They don't prevent viral infections. Probably increase the rate of bacterial infections. I don't know why anyone thinks wearing a warm, moist rag away from his mouth for hours at a time is going to be a good thing. And I've looked into the Pfizer vaccine, and there's no access to the patient-level data. That's a deal breaker right there. The trial protocol blatantly instructs clinicians to break the blind and not test people for COVID if they think they're in the treatment arm. So of course they had fewer cases of COVID in the treatment arm. And they did, like I said, there's no access to the patient level data, but they recently did release data on COVID-like illness, and they're almost identical in the treatment arm and the placebo arm. And you wonder how many of those cases of COVID-like illness in the treatment arm were COVID that they just didn't test for.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and that's interesting. You're getting a different take, not in conclusions, but in the details. You're so good at the details. You often give me new information, and you're going to be doing that for all of us on the COVID area too.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Just a paper just came out in Nature, and they basically found no evidence that the social distancing makes any difference.
Right.
They were comparing, they were measuring people's movements through tracking people through their cell phone. And they made like 3,700 pairwise comparisons of different districts. And I think in 60 of them, there was a significant difference. And the other 3,700 or whatever, there was no significant difference. So basically, they're saying the social distancing doesn't work. And, you know, I mean, the only reason I can see that they're insisting on the masks is to keep us all in a state of fear. How else are we supposed to know there's a deadly pandemic? Certainly not because our loved ones are dropping dead right and left.
Yeah, hardly anybody knows anyone who's died.
Yeah.
My closest connection to, but some people do. I mean, they're older people, people my age in their 80s who are ill and untreated, not treated properly, but if they're getting the proper treatment protocols. By the way, I want to remind people that if you go to the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, just Google them, Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, or actually if you purchase my book, you know, by going to the wearethepray.com, wearethepray.com, you'll see in the manuscript, but you can go right to the association, AAPS.com, and you'll find that there are good treatments for COVID-19 that your doctors aren't allowed to use by their governors who are in cahoots with everybody else to essentially make us all get vaccines and make us all more docile. But there are good treatments that you can get right away. You can call on the phone outside your own state. If you can't do it in your state, they can still send stuff to your pharmacies. They can still get you material, you know, get you treated. And I've done that for a family member of ours in another state. And within a day, she felt better, as often happens when proper treatment has begun. So that's just such an important lesson to remind everybody about. And let's go back and talk some, by the way, I'm so glad to see what I keep finding, which is that when people who really are scientific look at the COVID-19 stuff, they come to the same conclusion that the rest of us do. So welcome to the COVID-19 club of scientists who are just seeing all this stuff that is going on out there in the world. And what is your take overall on psych drugs? Let's go back to that, because I've been depriving people of psych drug talks lately. You know, there's no question for me that overall, we'd actually be better off in this world if we didn't have psychiatric drugs. I mean, they do more harm than good. They give people terrible ideas that their brain diseases like liver or heart disease, and that you can somehow ameliorate or even cure the disease with a medication. The drugs promise no cure at all. And they don't even want a cure. So it doesn't matter then, because it's well known in the pharmaceutical industry that what makes money is if you patient stays sick but thinks they need your drug. So you never want to tell the diabetes, the individual with diabetes in older life, who's kind of overweight, just as they show them on the ads, that if that individual began to eat a vegetable, a plant-based diet, they wouldn't need any drugs at all. And then if they threw in a mild exercise to boot, they'd just be a lot happier and better off across the whole board of existence. They really want chronic illness. It's really quite dreadful.
As I was finishing the writing of my book, there was a paper in, I think it was in Journal of the American Medical Association or New England Journal of Medicine. They were talking about psychiatry's identity crisis, that there's no coherent theoretical understanding of mental illness, that there's an over-reliance on that psychiatric diagnostic categories are, they're not, there's no evidence of any kind of biological signs. And there's an over-reliance on symptom, overlapping symptom checklists and hurried medication management visits. And really, I'm thinking to myself, psychiatry has been writhing in the throes of this identity crisis for the past 45 years. Is it time to consider the possibility that the entire field is just a wrong turn in human history?
Yes, it goes all the way back 2,500 years or so, because some of the very earliest classical literature, dramas that are that people still have access to from way back then. One of the earliest ones ridicules the physician who thinks he knows who's mentally ill, and gives them drugs that make them sick, and it turns out the physician's mentally ill in this particular play, and the patient's just fine. So this crisis goes back probably all the way to the earliest stages of medicine, because as soon as a doctor stepped outside of treating the body, he got into, or she got into, an area that was about the human spirit. And very likely the shaman who brought together the whole family to give support to the person who was hallucinating out of stress and whatever other, you know, environmental factors were going into his breakdown, that was going to do so much better if the whole family gathered around and some smoke was made or something was taken that wasn't going to destroy the person and wouldn't have to take for the rest of his life, and things would get better. And you know as well as I am sure about the World Health Organization trials that were done. They wanted to show how effective the antipsychotic drugs were for so-called schizophrenia across all different levels of industrialization, and they found out that in fact they didn't work very well at all anywhere, and the places where the recovery rates were the highest were in the non-industrialized nations, where you had extended family and the access to the drugs was very poor. So it was inverse to the drugs, and it was related to the kind of emotional support you got. When I'm working with somebody that's really, really seriously distressed, I try as much as I can to involve the family and the support, and if at all possible, instead of blaming the parents, if they are now trying to be caring and loving, I tell them that the most important thing is you have the power to help heal. So let's all get together and I'll help you learn how to communicate lovingly and talk to each other better and let go of things that are hurtful and learn to make all your comments to each other enhancing of each other. And these ideas that no psychiatrist has ever dared suggest, because their comments haven't been enhancing, how are they gonna encourage families to be enhancing?
Yeah, when I, my first book, as you know, I was on the genetic basis of mental illness, and I chose to focus on schizophrenia, which has always been regarded, of all the conditions called mental illness, it's always been regarded as the most likely to have a biological or genetic basis. And I reviewed the evidence and concluded there's no genetic basis to this condition. And then, obviously, the logical next question is, well, what does cause these complaints? And I found there is just a mountain of evidence that these complaints that fall under the diagnostic label schizophrenia are caused, not triggered, caused by child sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, and every other category of adverse childhood experience.
I think neglect is so important for people to realize they may have no memories of abuse, which doesn't mean there aren't any, yeah, any abuse, but that it, one of the most devastating things of all is to just be in an unloving environment where you're aware on some deep level of not being nurtured, and it can start early on. And that's something people have difficulty realizing. And you could have very good, well-meaning parents who were so wounded themselves, they couldn't love and nurture. And, you know, one of my tests is, were your parents as glad to see you as the dog was when you got home? And, you thought that the dog loved you more than your parents did. Well, the dog was better at expressing it for sure.
Yeah.
And you were missing out.
Yeah, and there's a mountain of evidence. And I quickly came to see I wasn't even going to be able to read it all.
No, no, nobody could.
And we have a whole industry now of neuroimaging and genome-wide association studies, and they've just generated mountains of data. They haven't found any kind of neurological cause of mental illness, and they haven't found any gene for mental illness. But you're always reading stories in the popular media about the genetic basis of mental illness, and they never say how tiny these effect sizes are. So-called schizophrenia-associated alleles, effect sizes are on the order of 1 in 500, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 2,000. How can a gene correlated with a 1 in 500 increase in your risk of being diagnosed with schizophrenia be said to be a cause of schizophrenia? I've been searching for a simile to show how absurd the whole thing seems to me, and I think I've succeeded. Hear me out.
Gladly.
Suppose a woman is getting ready to leave for work in the morning, and she stops, takes a minute to clean some bird droppings off her windshield. And then when she's driving to work, a drunk driver plows past a red light and slams into her and kills her. Now, if this woman had not stopped to clean the bird droppings off her windshield, she would have left for work a minute earlier, and she would have missed the drunk driver, and she'd still be alive. So should we say the bird droppings on her windshield were the cause of this woman's death? Now imagine every time that somebody dies in an automobile accident, they look for some trivial factor or incident that was somehow, some way connected to it, and all the while missing, and all the while turning a complete blind eye to the role of drunk driving in vehicular homicide. And that would be beyond absurd, but it's no more absurd than what we do. We talk about adverse childhood experiences and the role of adverse childhood experiences in causing mental illness. And of course, they've got an artful dodge, the biologically based psychiatrists. They will always say any discussion of these things is blaming the parents. And in a sense, I guess they're right. Well, a lot of these factors are beyond the parents' control, like the death of a parent.
That's right.
Natural
death. That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But leave that aside for the moment. I mean, if a tennis coach tells a player, you're hitting that shot wrong, is he blaming the tennis player? Well, I guess he is. But I don't know how to get better at anything without first taking a look at what you're doing wrong. And of course, there's ways of getting that information across without demeaning the other person as a human being. And that's called tact. I would hope somebody who chooses to make a living as a therapist has at least the average amount of tact. If your therapist doesn't, you can always...
I don't think that's tested for as a part of becoming a therapist. Yeah. I think it's whether you got A's in your all your regular courses or something. That's very good, Patrick Hahn, H-A-H-N. That's really good. It's very, very good. The way I approach it, and I think this may all be interesting to people, is I'll bring in the parents with the permission of the patient, unless it's a five-year-old, and then I'll say, I'd like to bring in your patients, your mother and your father. And one of the first things I'll say is, and it's a little different than what you're thinking. I mean, what you're thinking is pretty traditionally psychiatric in a sense that you can't change yourself without knowing something about how you got there. But of course you can, and you know that too. I mean, people change with religious experiences all the time. They change when they meet a new person, a loved one, when they finally have a loving relationship. They change when they have success, sometimes for the worse, but usually for the better. But the way I approach it is I bring everybody together and I say, I want to reassure you that this is not the time we're going to look at what's wrong. I mean, everybody in this room feels bad, feels guilty, feels shame, feels upset, and there's just no reason to stir that up anymore. What I can tell you is that the most powerful therapeutic tool we have is in this room, and it's your love for each other. And so starting today in this first session together, I want to help each of you let yourself express more love and care for each other. And then we'll start to talk, and I'll say, I might interrupt and say, well, let me suggest you notice that when you say that to your daughter, she grimaces. If she's grimacing, it isn't working. So just see it, watch your daughter's face, see if she kind of gets a bright look on her in her eyes because of something you've said. And Jane, I see you doing the same thing to your mother. You're just ready to pounce on her. So I want all of us to just work on a fresh start. And again, I just work on their communications and helping them really enjoy being together. And then over time, we may look at some of the background issues, or I may just do that separately with the individual because the parents are just in no condition to deal with that stuff. They've been through their own stuff. And also, if there is a predisposing aspect to people who get psychotic that we call schizophrenic, the predisposition, I think, would be for unique creativity. Because so often they are just these sensitive, aware, creative people. So they're born into Jane and Joe's family, and Jane and Joe have no idea what to do with somebody who is so alert to nuance and so feels the discord and the disjuncture that the family's used to, and they have no idea about. So I don't think we have to necessarily assume the parents are to blame. So what I like to start with is if the parents are well-meaning, the parents can be the most healing force there is. And then if we want to, we can look back later on. And it's often not important for the family to resolve earlier issues, and it's awfully difficult. What the family needs to know is they can actually have good times, loving times, productive times together again. So interesting, but it's this folks, is not a conversation you're going to hear in your psychiatric seminar ever. And you're probably not even going to get it in the social work or clinical psychology seminar, but you have a little better chance maybe in social work. Maybe a family therapist, child and family therapist should get this kind of training. So they're good ones to think about. But in general, for people who are really in difficulty, you want to work with the whole family, build up support, unless it's just doing real well, one-to-one, and that's what they want. Always this choice involved. Your thoughts, Patrick?
Yeah, in my first book, I mean, after, you know, first I looked at the supposed genetic basis of mental illness, found there wasn't any. And then I looked at the true causes and found there's overwhelming evidence that these are caused by sexual abuse and other adverse childhood experiences. And then in the third part of the book, I went and I found there is a long and rich, the fact that these conditions are caused by social factors suggests that they could be ameliorated by social factors. And I found there was a long and rich tradition going all the way back to the 18th century of treating these complaints with kindness, compassion, rest, time, exercise, wholesome food, beginning with St. Luke's Hospital in the UK and the retreat at York and the Salpêtrière and some other places. And I noticed a lot of these madhouse doctors, including Ryle, who coined the term psychiatry, stressed the importance of keeping the patient's family away from them.
Yes.
He never said why.
Increases the doctor's power.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it was to keep them away from toxic family members.
Oh, I don't know about that.
You're right.
maybe so. I mean, I've grown so cynical about people in power. And the psychiatrists, are such as a profession, we've been power-hungry monsters from so early on. And you know, the first two of those three places you mentioned are religiously based, and the real success was with the religious-based places because they had a religious basis for loving one another, and they had a religious basis for praying together and being together. And although I don't belong to an institutional religion, I identify strongly with being Jewish and Ginger's Christian, but you need a loving framework to work from within, and the psychiatrist didn't have that. And these other facilities actually worked to keep the psychiatrists out, the doctors out. They didn't believe in them, their drugs. They believed in a glass of wine and a good meal at night. And if the person was manic and out of control, they believed in teaching non-restraint persuasion, being with a person, addressing them morally, addressing them as one of God's children. And they worked trained their people not to use force. And they were very successful. There's no indication that the places did better, that evolved. We call psychiatric hospitals, and of course they weren't destroying them and making them permanent patients like we tend to do now.
Yeah, and this tradition has continued through the 20th century. Frieda Fromm Reichman, Chestnut Lodge, R.D. Lang at Gartnerville, and Lauren Mosher with the Soteria House.
Yeah.
I guess they abandoned that, but...
Every one of them has been destroyed by the forces of evil. Yeah. So none of them exist in any shape or form now. We don't have a genuine Soteria House anywhere. Because you see, the good is driven out by the bad, because the bad is always the power structure. We're seeing that in American politics now. The bad drives out the good because it's unscrupulous, and the psychiatrists have been unscrupulous. They a person like myself or Lauren Mojo, who created Soteria House, we have been, they've done everything in their power to get us out of this, out of the system, out of their sight, out of the public arena. And of course, we don't do that. We don't go around doing that. We don't, first of all, we don't have the power to do it. So we're good, like, simply because we don't have the power to do that much harm they can do. But so none of them exist right now, folks. And that's partly because the pharmaceutical industry has reached a real pinnacle of power in the last couple of decades that it never had before. And that is the same thing you're seeing. I talk about global predators in COVID-19 book. The pharmaceutical industry is kind of a central space of power in among the global power people, and other people like Bill Gates invest in them and support them. And Fauci works with Gates investing in the vaccine industry and stuff like that. So that power has crushed the alternatives in psychiatry. You're much better off going to a non-medical therapist to seek help. Yeah. Somebody, and vet them on the phone. Say to them on the phone, listen, I really want to see somebody who's not going to send me to the psychiatrist if you're a little concerned. And probably most people who call will say, well, I have to send you to the psychiatrist. And until you get somebody who says, no, I've never done that in my life. And then you think, well, maybe that person knows how to help.
Yeah.
Because if somebody tells you you need to see a psychiatrist, let's say they're a social worker or a psychologist, you need to see a psychiatrist. That means they don't feel competent to help a person like you. And notice they're not saying, maybe you should try another therapist. I don't want to abandon you, so I'll still see you. But, you know, maybe you should see a man. I know a good guy. Maybe that'd be better for you, or an older person. Or, you know, because obviously, you know, you're not getting better. You should get better. So let's see what we can do. They never think that way. They're not trained. They're trained to literally think, if you're not getting better, see me and once a week in my chair. There's something the matter with you. You need drugs. That's bizarre. It's a bizarre conclusion.
And the media is heavily dependent on drug company advertising.
Yeah.
In my book, Prescription for Sorrow, just come up and cite example after example of the sycophantic coverage the media has given.
Yes, you're doing a good job.
Great. The Newsweek devoted not one, but two cover stories to Prozac.
Made it pill of the year.
They had
who knew?
Had the larger than life replica of the Prozac capsule or pulvule, as they called it, hovering over the landscape and people looking up at it like it was the second coming of Jesus Christ.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And one of them, they were talking about a new drug in development, which was said to improve learning and memory in rats. And then the article burbled, who could criticize a drug that stamps the rules for long division in your child's head after a single lesson?
Oh, God.
Yeah, where's that drug? Where's the pill for long division? That was 27 years ago. Yeah.
You do a very good job in his book, folks, in Prescription for Sorrow. Patrick Hahn does a very good job on showing that every time that the drug companies and their psychiatric and other supporters fail in a controlled clinical trial to show the drug works, they always assume there's something wrong with the controlled clinical trial. So they have no respect for science at all. It's not like they're trying to find out something, which is science. Science is where you try to find out something. Applied science is where you try to build something, and fraudulent science is where you try to be dishonest and get a result by any trick you can think of, which is what the drug companies do. They never say, geez, we fail. We've got the 12 drug companies here, and we put all our studies together. We still can't show the antidepressants work. And so let's see now, what's our mistake? And you do a really good job of showing that ridiculousness. It's not science. One of the things you need to realize is everything Fauci is saying about COVID-19, everything the same drug companies are saying about psych drugs in particular, and to a great extent, unfortunately, all drugs, it's all concocted stuff. None of it comes out of genuine science. There are no Einsteins at work. There are no people who are working for the drug companies who are independent scientists. They're all hacks hired to prove by any means possible that the drug is positive. That is not science. That isn't by definition. So, and that's what's going on with the vaccines, which I now recommend we have to have a moratorium. We have over 1,600 deaths in the U.S. associated with the taking vaccine within a week or two, many of them after the first day with allergic reactions, cytokine storms, probably COVID-19 developing, COVID cases from the vaccines. So the same there, that's not science. The stuff that got pushed through the FDA was a massive effort to prove something. They couldn't. So the FDA couldn't actually give it approval. They just gave it emergency clearance to be used. That's what the EAU is, the emergency use for the drug. And EUA, it's just not a good idea to use that. We need to study it more. I just interviewed Dr. McCullough for a short video coming out in a week. He's really one of the world's experts. And he pointed out that 11 countries in Europe now are refusing one or another of the vaccines. So it isn't anything radical to say we got to stop this and evaluate the data we have. That's what I think we should do.
There's never been a time in the peacetime history of any country, maybe not even in the wartime, when there's history. There's been so much effort to make people afraid.
Yes, this that's the key.
Of propaganda. The I remember a year ago in Italy, which then became the epicenter of the infection, and reading the average age of COVID deaths was 80. And the average person who died had three complicating medical conditions. Right. And I thought, wait a minute. Okay, then the sky is not falling in. And I thought this hysteria would blow over in a couple of weeks. Oh, God, was I wrong. You know, the day after Thanksgiving, I went to visit my nephew and my nieces. And we went for a walk, and it was a beautiful day, unseasonably warm day. And they were the perfect age for such an undertaking. They're old enough to have an intelligent conversation with, but young enough that they still actually want to spend time with the old man. And so we had just barely gotten underway, and we saw this couple, both wearing masks, like a couple hundred yards away from us. And the middle child, the girl, piped up and she said, "We have to go back. We'll get the corona." And right then I knew I had to do something about this.
Yeah. It is. It's very sad. They're terrifying our children and making them basically paranoid and submissive to authority. And it's quite a tragedy. It's so good to have our first conversation about the coronavirus. And I want to encourage you to just continue working. One thing you'll find is very different once you get into this area, in that there are a lot of good, decent physicians around the world working in this area, all of whom share similar views. It's not like psychiatry, where basically I was alone my whole career. And still I'm kind of alone as a psychiatrist. There's one or two, three, four other people sort of involved in medicine. But most of the critics are like you. They don't have a vested interest. So they're non-medical people. But in this area, I'm just one of a whole big, wonderful school of COVID you know, truth-seeking people.
I mean, it's just so obvious to me that the damage done by the lockdown associated restrictions is greater than the damage done by COVID.
Oh, not even close.
There, 3 million children have dropped off the radar. They're not in school. They're not attending Zoom classes.
That's interesting.
Nobody knows what's happened to them.
I didn't know that data. That's very important.
Yeah. And there was an article in ABC News about prescriptions for drugs for ADHD has skyrocketed. And they had all these eminently credentialed experts in the article talking about how stressful this is for children to be cut off from friends. And, you know, oftentimes their parents are having financial problems, losing their jobs. And all this is true. But I'm reading this and thinking to myself, wait a minute. Have all these eminently credentialed experts just admitted that ADHD is not a genetically based brain but just perfectly understandable reactions to distressing circumstances?
Oh, boring circumstances.
Yeah.
Boring.
Yeah, that's
weird. All ADHD kids can do things they love.
Yeah. That's the subject of my third book right away, which I'm just putting the finishing touches on.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad to see you doing that.
In June.
That's great.
Yeah,
this is we're about finishing up here in a minute. This is Patrick's book. It comes with a stamp of approval from Peter R. Breggin, MD. It's a really good book. And remember that you can now also, I'm going to be talking about this. I want to mention this at every one of my appearances in the immediate future. And that is that my wife and I, our new book, you can get an advanced order on it now. The COVID-19 and the global predators. And it's a wonderful book. It's got three introductions, short introductions by top physicians, medical people in the COVID-19 field who say it's the most comprehensive, interesting, and thrilling. Reads like a, you know, this and that, they say in their little intros. And so this is the book, I think, for COVID-19 right now. And you can get it by advance order by going to www.wearethepray.com, wearethepray.com. And of course, you can get it off Breggin.com. And if you sign up now, you'll not only get a cut rate, you'll get immediately the manuscript for the book. Never heard of an author doing that before, because this stuff is too critical. The information has to go out. You're going to see the typos. You're going to see the problems with the manuscript that is just hasn't been even come back yet from the copy editor. So, and I'm not a great copy editor, so it's got glitches here and there, and but they're minor. And that'll give you all the information you need right there. The minute you click to purchase the book, it just goes. We have this great new assistant. You'll get 450-page manuscript with 800 sites sitting in your email in a PDF, easy to read. Patrick Hahn, welcome to the world of COVID-19. It is so great to have you here. We'll stay in touch. And I suspect that in a not too long a time, you'll be one of the more informed COVID people. So that'll be exciting.
Okay.
Thanks great. For being on the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, my friend. Thank you so much.
Having me.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.